Tehran Stories, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Marco's on assignment this week in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and he's excited to be there.
There are just places around the globe that no matter how much you read about, you hear about, unless you go there yourself, you can't really know what it's all about.
We'll hear his first impressions. Also, an Aboriginal comedian in Australia uses humor to tackle racial discrimination.
For me, it's my grandmother always used to say to me, "What can you do if you can't laugh?" And she was saying that, like, she said it on the day she died.
Plus, remember Anthony from the famous Prince Spaghetti ad? He remembers being a newly arrived immigrant in Boston's North End in the 1960s.
I was 9 years old, and the North End back then was like, you never left Italy.
Those stories, today on The World. Marco's in Iran this week, and you'll be hearing his stories all this week and next. He's on the line now from Tehran. Marco, first impressions, how is it?
Getting in at 3 in the morning, Carol, pretty dark, except for the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, which is very visible at night. It's this giant complex that kind of looks a bit like a monastery, but with four giant minarets that are illuminated in green light. But when I woke up, the city kind of looks and feels a little like Paris. Really noisy, wide avenues with quiet neighborhoods off to the sides, lots of mixed residential and commerce in the same buildings. And it's just so weird to actually be here. It's a place that I've wanted to visit for some time because there are just places around the globe that no matter how much you read about, you hear about, unless you go there yourself, you can't really know what it's all about. So now I'm here, don't know if I'm going to find out what it's all about. But it's a world-class city. It's got tons of traffic, or as one woman told me today, it's a city that's a parking lot. Right now, it's a parking lot with a keen sense of history. February 11th, this Thursday, is the big national holiday, the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. So you see billboards everywhere with pictures of martyrs from the war with Iraq or murals of Khomeini. But most impressive was this massive photograph that stretched across 8 lanes of highway in Tehran on this overpass that showed Khomeini's triumphant return from Paris back in 1979, surrounded by mobs on the highway coming in from the airport. That was what started this whole revolution. It's pretty mind-blowing, the whole thing.
So, Marco, how did you even get there?
You know, not that hard, really, Carol, if you've got the visa. Turkish Airlines, Lufthansa, Emirates, they all come to Tehran. And one of the things that really struck me, just in terms of how the American-Iranian estrangement over the years has kind of shaped out, it's kind of neutralized any sense of who the Iranians are. So I'm standing in line waiting for the plane to Tehran to board in Istanbul. And first of all, half the women are wearing their hijabs. The other half will wait until the last minute on the plane before landing to put them on. The faces of all the people kind of seem to represent a rainbow of the Middle East, from Semitic to almost blonde. And compared to the Iranian officials I met years ago, right after the start of the revolution, they only wore white shirts buttoned up to the neck with a black suit jacket. Everyone on this plane had an individual sense of style. It was almost like boarding a plane anywhere in the U.S., just people getting on a plane and going home.
Now, I know you just got there, but do you have any sense yet of how the nuclear deal has changed life there?
Yeah, it's really obvious. Check this out. I was told today by a government official that 1 week after the nuclear deal was inked, over 100 French business types came to see what opportunities there are here. And it really hasn't stopped since. So just a couple of anecdotes I've heard today. The big deal that was announced last week with the French company Airbus, Iran's going to buy more than 100 planes from them, including a few A380s, which are, you know, the double-decker pride of their fleet. They're badly needed because Iran Air is still flying really old aircraft, including a nearly 40-year-old super long-range 747 SP. It's the only one in the world that's still flying. So Iran is looking at a lot more people coming here and presumably flying from here to places around the globe as the sanctions continue to get lifted. The most eye-opening story, though, was from a woman named Nazanin Daneshvar, who's a 32-year-old entrepreneur. She's kind of started the Iranian version of Groupon, and now she's tweaked her business model so that Groupon is copying her. Anyway, more about her later, but just listen to this really dynamic woman who, like a lot of people of her generation, knows about her past, even though she was born after the revolution, but she's really all about the present and the future of Iran.
Whenever I see an Iranian outside, it's just like, look, guys, we are the ones that are going to change this country. Otherwise, who's going to do it? Nobody's going to. My parents are not going to do it. They are not able of doing it. And if you sit there, you owe to this country.
And Carol, we're going to hear more from Nazanin in the coming days.
Marco, we've got to let you go, but can you share just a few more impressions of Tehran?
Yeah, you know, despite how hard it's been just to get permission to come here, I found this unexpected freedom and joy from being free from all the furniture of our main street commerce in the U.S. No Starbucks, no Gaps, no McDonald's. Though I have to say, at the Istanbul airport en route to Tehran, I noticed the Iranian national futsal team and chatted with them for a bit. And they were on their way out to Uzbekistan for the Asian Futsal Championship.
What is futsal?
Futsal, it's indoor soccer, yeah. And they were knocking back a lot of Burger King Whoppers and fries, carbon up for the tournament, just saying.
World's Marco Werman in Tehran, and we'll be catching up with you all week, Marco. Thanks so much.
You bet, Carol.
And don't forget, you can follow Marco on his Instagram account. He's posting pictures from Tehran using the hashtag TehranStories. From Iran, we turn to Syria and the city of Aleppo. We are on the verge of a new human tragedy. That's how Turkey's prime minister described the current situation in the Syrian city. Richard Hall is with our Global Post team. He's on the border between Turkey and Syria.
On the Syrian side of the border, there are approximately 50,000 people that are fleeing Russian airstrikes and Syrian government airstrikes in the city of Aleppo and the surrounding countryside.
You're saying 50,000 people. And so these are people coming down and they're massing at the border trying to get across?
That's correct. There may be many more on the way, in fact, according to people we've spoken to in the city of Aleppo. We spoke to a guy called Munir Mustafa, who was a member of the Civil Defense Force in Aleppo. That's a team of civilian rescue volunteers who say that as many as 100,000 people may have fled the city and the surrounding areas and may be heading towards the border. So the situation we're seeing now, which is bad as it is, may get worse in the coming days.
It's incredible to even imagine it. I'm curious why they're massing at this particular entry point. Are there other entry points they could go to, or is it just fleeing and getting out of this part of Syria as soon as possible?
The city of Aleppo and the line to the north that goes to the Turkey border is controlled by what many say are the mainstream rebels, that is, rebels that the US and the West has backed in the past. To the east, you have the Islamic State, and to the west, you have Kurdish forces, which aren't friendly to the Syrian rebels in this area. So they can't go to the east and they can't go to the west. And to the south is where the bombing is. So the only option they have is to go directly north. And this route, even this route that they have to the border, is not safe. Russian airstrikes are targeting the entire area. And the Syrian government is also doing the same.
Now, they're fleeing Aleppo. I know prior to Syria's war, this was the largest city in Syria. And I know you've been speaking to people there. What are they saying?
The situation in Aleppo is that people are preparing for a prolonged siege. The government has nearly encircled entirely the area to the north of Aleppo, almost cutting off the route from Aleppo to the border. So people there are storing food. This in turn is pushing up prices. We spoke to a man named Ahmed from the city who said that the price of food is going up because people are storing food. Fuel is going up. They're preparing for a long siege.
And I understand there's actually some refugees from Aleppo that are getting to the border and turning around and going back?
That's correct. We spoke to a man named Ayman who came to the border with two children. He's from a town called Tel Rifat, which is in this line from Aleppo to the border. It's in that area. He came to the border. He saw the situation at the camp and he decided that he would turn back. What he said to us was that dying is much better than being humiliated in this place. He said there was no water, there was no services. He had two sick children. And so he was one of those that decided to turn back. And we've heard similar stories from other people.
What about the Turkish authorities? What are they saying?
The relief effort is being led by the Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation, which is a kind of a coalition of aid organizations supported by the Turkish government. They're the ones that have set up camps on the Syrian side of the border. They're providing food, water, and blankets. And they've promised to build more camps on the Syrian side to house the new arrivals. The Turkish government is saying that they're full to capacity. They have 2.5 million Syrian refugees in the country, and they say they can't handle any more.
Now, I know Angela Merkel was in Turkey, I think today, talking to Turkish officials. What are they saying about what they're going to do about these 50,000 Syrians at the border?
At the moment, the Turkish government is saying if necessary, they will let them in. We're not sure how long this will take, and they've given no indication as to when that might happen. At the moment, they're trying to register those refugees so they can allow them in at some point.
Richard Hall reports for our Global Post team. He's in Turkey near the Syrian border. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you very much.
A French social media campaign recently caught our eye. It featured a hashtag, Tous avec une kippa, everyone with a kippa, or Jewish skullcap. It was a call for Jews and non-Jews alike to put on a kippa in a show of solidarity. It came after a young Jewish student in Marseille was attacked with a machete. In the aftermath of the attack, a Jewish leader there urged Jews not to wear kippahs or anything that signaled that they were Jewish until the security situation improved. But many Jews in France don't see that happening anytime soon. From Paris, Emma Jacobs has the story.
You could walk by Temple Cahill at Gesher in Paris without realizing it's here if it weren't for the soldiers, three of them in camouflage and carrying automatic rifles.
I'm very thankful because the French army saved my religious school.
Rabbi Tom Cohen is originally from the States. He helped found the congregation here.
Because right after the attack of the Charlie Hebdo and Hyper Kasher, the parents were frightened about ever sending their kids back to a synagogue.
The Hyper Kasher is the Jewish supermarket that was attacked a few days after Charlie Hebdo in January 2015. Four people were killed there. Shortly after, the French government put soldiers outside synagogues all over the country. Cohen had six guards at his temple round the clock. The ones off duty napped in his basement office.
And there was enough firepower in my front room here to take out a small village.
These days, the soldiers are only stationed out front when temple members are inside.
Because we're all starting to worry about there's a tired factor that comes in.
Because it's not clear when this will be over. On the one-year anniversary of the Hyper Kasher attack, a dozen vanloads of national police stood guard at a commemorative vigil in Paris. Estelle, who's in her early 20s, was there. She asked that we only use her first name because of safety concerns. She says the heavy police presence feels necessary these days, if not exactly comforting. In the end, it's the thing that keeps us safe. It's not normal, but we learn to live with it. And France has been living with smaller attacks on Jewish institutions for some time. Journalist Mark Weitzman says it started to escalate in 2000, around the beginning of the Second Palestinian Intifada. He says Jews in France became a target for young radicalized Muslims. But the country as a whole was slow to recognize the pattern of attacks.
That's when the Jews really started to feel very lonely in the country. And it's a sort of perverse dynamic. The more you say you're lonely, the more you turn out being lonely because everybody thinks you're crazy.
But since 2014, it's become harder to dismiss. That January, right-wing protests in Paris included large groups of people chanting anti-Semitic slogans.
The anti-Semitic slogans in the streets, that was really a first. You know, Jews, France doesn't belong to you. This was unheard since World War II.
And growing numbers of French Jews have had enough. An estimated 8,000 moved to Israel last year. Though Weitzman says France's weak economy is part of that, and many might return. But he does feel that French Jews' sense of belonging has been damaged.
The army in front of the synagogues, it protects the Jews in a way, but it also marks a definite difference. You know, it's like a border now.
Another woman I met at the Hyper Kasher Memorial also shared ambivalence about the soldiers in the streets, though for a different reason. Rosalie Solcom is not Jewish, but lives behind the kosher market. She watched the police stand off last year from her window, terrified a stray bullet would come through the wall. The soldiers on constant watch in her neighborhood have made it hard to forget. It's a little worrying. In some ways, we feel safe, but we also say to ourselves that the fact that they're still there, it's because there's a problem. And since the Paris attacks in November, she says, it's clear this problem is not going away anytime soon. But it's not just a few groups that are the targets now. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Fans of sketch comedy in Australia got welcome news recently.
They're back. Bigger, bolder, and blacker.
What's this then?
The new series of black comedy starts Wednesday, February 3 on ABC and iView.
That's the trailer announcing the start of season 2 of Black Comedy. Its co-writer and star is Nakia Louie. Louie grew up in a suburb of Sydney, but much of her work is informed by her background. Her father is a Torres Strait Islander. They're ethnically like people in Papua New Guinea. Louie's mother is Gamilaroi, an Aboriginal people from interior Australia. Historically, Aboriginals have been mostly absent from Australian television. In fact, Black Comedy is the first Indigenous sketch comedy program on Australian TV in three decades. In its first season, the show found an audience that reached across class, color, and ethnicity in Australia. Louise says she and her team were surprised by its success.
When we did the first season, we weren't quite sure what the show was. And we literally came together over an advertisement that said, apply if you think you're a black fella and you're funny, which all like black fellas in Australia think they're hilarious. I think most people think they're hilarious. So we were kind of just, you know, the blind leading the blind.
Now, Americans are familiar with sketch comedy on shows like Saturday Night Live, Jimmy Fallon, and other shows. What kind of sketches are on black comedy?
Black comedy is a real mixed bag of sketches, which I think is what has made it so successful, because even though it has an Indigenous theme, it also has a real diverse variety of humour. So we have a lot of character sketches. We have these two kind of flamboyantly gay characters called titters, which is a term for like an Aboriginal term kind of around Australia for like sisters. So if you call someone a titter, you go, that's my sister. And that's a term that has like a really long legacy within the Aboriginal gay community. So we have these two titters who constantly try and one-up each other, and they're saying, what's this then about, you know, ridiculous things like dancing and eating and singing. We have the Housewives of Narromine. So Narromine is this very, very, like very small town in outback Australia. And the reason I know it is because I always used to pass there going to visit family who live in the bush. And it's based on, it's kind of a take on the Real Housewives show, but mm-hmm. they're in Narromine. We also have some very good like satire, I think. We have some very biting satire that a lot of the time is, and I think is a mark of good satire, is like it's met with sometimes a bit more uncomfortableness and from non-Aboriginal people and a lot of laughter from Aboriginal people.
It seems like part of what you're doing on black comedy is kind of challenging probably just white people's notion of Aboriginals or Indigenous Australians, kind of trying to shake up comfort levels. There's one sketch that's pretty funny, the police team that busts up a house and raids a house and accuses the residents of not being black enough.
We've got reason to believe your husband's guilty of not acting black.
What? How?
He bought a Delta Goodrum album.
What else has he done?
He's been ticking other nationality on all his forms. He's been buying organic groceries.
Oh.
And he hasn't had KFC in months.
So Black Force. Well, that just kind of came about like through ideas being thrown about in the room. And that was, I think it's this idea of what an Aboriginal person is meant to be. And it's something that speaks to, like, I mean, it's a real in-joke for the Aboriginal community because there's lots of, you know, cultural signifiers that I think only a lot of Aboriginal people in some respects can pick up on. I mean, in one episode, they say, party's over, put the mattress back in the lounge room. And that's a real blackfella joke because, like, any Aboriginal house you go to in the summer, they usually have a mattress in the lounge room because it's, you know, nice to have a lay down and watch TV and have a chat. So there's such a lack of diverse representation on Australian screens across the board. So what Black Force does is kind of we put our culture there on the screen through a parody, but we're also reclaiming it, I think, and we're giving that humour, giving the understanding, like have it coming from a black perspective. Black Force is received so well by non-Aboriginal people because they think they get the joke and the references, because a lot of the time it's about class. A lot of the time it's about, you know, we make a lot of hipster jokes in those sketches, you know, like what's kale? It's the latest food on the street.
I saw one of your spoken word performances and in it you said, at this stage of my life, I'm so over my ethnicity. What do you mean by that?
It's just like I've had to tick a box all my life. My mum's had to tick a box all her life. You know, my grandparents have had to not tick a box. They lived on missions, I think, which are the equivalent of like reserves in Australia, except they're managed by white people. So in a way, you know, when you have to, on like every single encounter that you have almost daily for all of your life, having to declare your ethnicity becomes, it becomes, I think, oppressive. It becomes tiring. It's something you become fearful of. I mean, I still get into cabs. We have this really big issue in Australia of taxi drivers not stopping for Aboriginal people. And it happens every year. There'll be a really prominent Aboriginal actor or actress, and they'll be doing like a show about Aboriginal people and or about civil rights or something at like a really well-known theatre company in Australia, and they won't get a cab.
That
story has
happened.
Yeah, they won't get a cab, and it'll go to the media, and we'll talk about racism again. But the thing is, it's like I'm not a dark-skinned Aboriginal person, and I get into a cab and I always get asked where I'm from because I can kind of pass for a lot of things. And I always get so scared to tell a taxi driver that I'm Aboriginal because you never know what you're going to face. You never know if it's going to be positive or negative. Having to deal with that every day, having that be your kind of signifier of who you are, whether that be positive or negative, it's tiring. You can never be seen as a human, as just a person, as just an artist. It's always the Aboriginal one.
What draws you to comedy and satire as a forum for addressing these issues?
For me, it's my grandmother always used to say to me, what can you do if you can't laugh? And she was saying that, like she said it on the day she died. And I think laughter is, like, it's so potent to deliver a message with a smile. Usually, like, you're led by your emotion. And when you're led by your emotion and you react so viscerally, you then have to kind of ask questions about why you feel like that. And hopefully from then asking questions, that then leads to discourse and discussion. Whereas I think sometimes with drama or with tragedy, and my theatre work is quite, it's quite dramatic and quite based in tragedy. It's quite different to my television work. I think sometimes the thing with drama and leading with thinking and logic is that people can opt out really early. They kind of know what kind of ride they're in for, and they can decide pretty early on as to whether they're going to go on that ride with you. Whereas with comedy, you can kind of take someone along with the ride and they don't even know that they're on it. So for me, that's why I love comedy as a tool. I just think it's so incredibly subversive.
Nakia Louie is an Australian writer, playwright, and actress. She's a co-writer and star of a sketch comedy TV show in Australia called Black Comedy. Thanks, Nakia.
Thank you.
And later in the show, we talk about Haiti, which right now is a country without a leader. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, why China's relationship with North Korea's Kim Jong-un is like a parent trying to get a teenager to behave.
They can't simply tell young Mr. Kim what to do because young Mr. Kim will not follow Chinese orders.
That story's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Quite a flyover during last night's Super Bowl festivities, and I'm not talking about the Blue Angels. No, I mean the North Korean satellite that reportedly passed over Levi's Stadium about an hour after the Broncos beat the Panthers. The rocket that sent that satellite into space on Sunday has North Korea watchers jittery. That's because many believe North Korea's real purpose was to test its ability to launch a nuclear missile. A host of nations, including the U.S., have condemned the act. Steve Sang is a fellow at the China Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham in Britain. He says North Korea's neighbor and main ally, China, isn't thrilled about the launch either.
Before the launch or the test, the Chinese authorities already told the North Koreans that they really would not like to see this happened. And then the North Koreans decided to hold the test on the eve of the Chinese New Year. So I think they get the attention of the Chinese leadership.
How has the Chinese government responded?
Well, they are trying to respond in a measured way. So what they have done is that they support the initiative at the UN to impose sanctions, but they are also asking for all sides to respond in a calm way in order to avoid escalation in the region or potentially destabilizing the Korean Peninsula.
It's interesting because in the West, there's this perception that China, as North Korea's only real ally, has influence over Pyongyang and could stop them from taking these provocative actions if they wanted to. It doesn't sound like that's the case, is it?
Well, it is not the case because the Chinese do not want to see North Korea implode or get into a serious difficulty that could potentially lead to a confrontation over the Korean Peninsula. And the North Koreans know that. And that is why the North Koreans are behaving the way they did with the Chinese. They are at the moment taking the Chinese for granted, and the Chinese don't like it.
So in a way, they're sort of taunting Beijing by doing these tests. I mean, but China's a huge country, really powerful, and again, North Korea's only real ally. Could China prevent North Korea and sort of lay down the law and make them stop doing this if they wanted to?
Well, the Chinese can make it very painful for the North Korean leadership and the North Korean people in terms of cutting off economic and other relationship with the North Koreans. But that's as much as they can actually do. They could make it so difficult that the North Koreans might do something silly and that could potentially cause a bit of a problem in the Korean Peninsula. But they can't simply tell young Mr. Kim what to do, because young Mr. Kim will not follow Chinese orders.
And is he unique in that respect? Has North Korea's relationship with China soured since the rise of Kim Jong-un?
It was difficult even under the father of Kim Jong-un. But the young Mr. Kim has gone way beyond what his father or grandfather did in the relationship with the Chinese. Ever since Kim Jong-un came to power, he has refused or avoided visiting China. So he's not projecting any image that he pay too much attention to what the Chinese want them to do.
What does that leave then for the long-term outlook for China's relationship with North Korea? I mean, is Beijing comfortable with the way this regime is behaving?
No, Beijing is not comfortable with the way how the North Korean regime is behaving. But the big problem for the Chinese really is in China itself. At the moment, the Chinese government actually has better relationship with the South Korean government in Seoul than it does with the North Korean government in Pyongyang. So the prospect of an implosion of North Korea and a unification of the Korean Peninsula should not pose that much of a problem for the Chinese. But that is not the way how the Chinese sees it. Equally, if they allow the North Korean regimes to implode, then one of the very last communist or rather Leninist political systems will collapse in the world. And that would signal to dissidents in China that they could attempt to challenge the dominance of the Communist Party in China. And that's the last thing the Communist Party of China will ever allow.
Steve Tsang is a senior fellow at the Chinese Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham in Britain. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
We want to check in on a story that's gripping both Egypt and Italy right now. It concerns a 28-year-old Italian student named Giulio Regeni. He was in Egypt researching labor movements for Cambridge University. But on January 25th, the day commemorating the Arab Spring Uprising, Regeni vanished. A week later, his body was found, and there were signs he may have been tortured. Italy is demanding to know what happened. Declan Walsh of the New York Times has been following the story from Cairo. He says lots of details about the case are still unclear.
We don't know very much. We know that he left his apartment on the evening of the 25th. That was an extremely tense day here in Cairo. It was the fifth anniversary of the start of the uprising in 2011 that eventually led to the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak. So the security forces were on high alert. The government here was very sensitive to any suggestion that there would be any form of organized protest on that day. And indeed, there was very little. But what that did mean is that the city was pretty much on lockdown. There were police and security officials everywhere. And on that evening, when, if you like, most of the tension seemed to have dissipated, Giulio Regeni left his apartment. He messaged a friend who he was due to meet in the city center near Tahrir Square. He told him that he was coming on the metro. And that's the last anybody heard of him.
Why are the Egyptian security forces a suspect?
The Egyptians obviously are denying any involvement in this directly, but the Italian government has been extremely forthright in its statements about this. They've avoided directly accusing the Egyptians, but in many senses, they've done all but that. They have repeatedly stressed the need for the truth. They have pointed to the quite gruesome injuries that Giulio Regeni had suffered before he died. He had multiple cigarette burns on his body. and he had wounds to his face. He had other signs of what Egyptian officials call extensive torture, and that has really inflamed public opinion in Italy. There's been huge coverage of this story, and there's been intensive pressure from Italian officials who really seem to be convinced that the Egyptian government is behind this. And I suppose partly that's because the injuries that Giulio Regeni suffered are consistent with the sort of injuries that many Egyptians have suffered who have disappeared into the custody of the security forces.
What are Egyptian authorities saying in terms of what might have happened to Giulio Regeni?
The Egyptians say they're treating this extremely seriously, that it is a murder investigation. The prosecutor who's investigating this case on behalf of the state, he was the first person who said that Mr. Regeni was tortured and that it's a crime. And there is currently a joint investigation going on at the moment with an Italian team of investigators who arrived in Egypt last Friday, and they will be working with the Egyptians to try and uncover the truth about this. Of course, part of the skepticism for many people in Italy is that how these Italian investigators will uncover the truth about an Egyptian crime when, for many people, the prime suspects in this crime are those same Egyptian security forces.
All of this comes at a time when Washington and Cairo are meeting over, of all things, human rights. Is this murder of Giulio Regeni, is that likely to impact the diplomatic meetings?
I think it's certainly going to be an issue up for discussion in both Cairo and Washington. This week here in Cairo, Dr. Sarah Sewell, who is the Undersecretary of State, who is responsible for human rights issues, she's here in Cairo meeting with civil society leaders, religious leaders, and Egyptian government officials. So I think given the intensity of the attention on Mr. Regeni's case, I think it's very likely that it's going to come up in those discussions. And I think questions will certainly be asked about whether the Egyptian government is taking this investigation seriously and, you know, who they intend to bring to book for this if it is confirmed that the Egyptian security forces had a hand in Mr. Regeni's disappearance.
This case of the murder of Giulio Regeni is just so horrifying. I mean, he didn't go there to die. He was there working on a dissertation. Is this case unprecedented in terms of a international graduate student or something like this ending up dead in this particular manner?
Well, there obviously have been high-profile cases in Egypt in recent years of foreigners running afoul of the authorities. But, you know, it certainly is unusual for a foreigner to suffer violence like this. So I think it's certainly for people in the academic community and more broadly, I think, among foreigners, been quite a sobering spectacle, what happened to Giulio Regeni. There's a sense that red lines have shifted here in Egypt.
Declan Walsh is a reporter with the New York Times. He's been speaking to us from Cairo. Thanks, Declan.
My pleasure.
Good news, bad news in Haiti. First, the good. It's Carnival. But the bad news is that Carnival celebrations have been delayed. That's because Michel Martelly reached the end of his term as president and stepped down. But there's no successor. No one's really in charge right now, and there are tensions across the country. Reporter Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, explain how this came about. Why wasn't there a presidential replacement?
Well, there were elections that were held October 25th, presidential first-round elections. And immediately after those elections, the opposition, including some of the 54 candidates who participated in these elections, alleged that there was massive fraud. So for months, these fraud allegations have clouded these elections. And as a result, last month, the Electoral Council was forced to postpone the vote after the opposition candidate who qualified, Jude Celestin, said that he would not participate. Immediately after that, we started to see incidents of violence in the days leading up to the second round, which was supposed to be held on the 24th of January. And so President Michel Martelly left office on February 7th without an elected successor.
So the long and short of it is that Haiti does not have a president right now because of irregularities in an election that an initial election that would have produced a runoff or a second round. So who is in charge in Haiti at the moment?
Well, that's an interesting question, because on one hand, we have a parliament that was elected, but they also have been dogged by allegations of fraud. There are a couple of members in parliament who have been accused of buying their seat or that they were declared winners when all of the vote had not taken place. And we also have a prime minister who really is in a caretaker role. He's resigned. So right now there is a real power vacuum in the country.
How volatile is the situation there? I mean, we've got a vacuum at the top and we've got Carnival. What's going on in Haiti now?
Well, it is volatile because what happened on Sunday, which was the first day of Carnival, the prime minister's office canceled Carnival because we had protests that were going on in the street. You had supporters of Matéli who, you know, were in the street peacefully, you know, guiding him home to give him his send off. But at the same time, you had the opposition that's in the streets and they're continuing to remain in the streets because a lot of them do not agree with this agreement. It was a last minute deal that was forged by Matéli and the leaders of both chambers of parliament that outlined the steps for putting in an interim president as well as a consensus prime minister, which is supposed to happen by the end of this week. But there's so much disagreement, even within the opposition, over this last minute deal that we really don't know if by the end of this week, Haiti will actually have a provisional government in charge.
So as long as this vacuum is in place, no Carnival?
We're still trying to figure out whether or not the party is going to go on today. Two major bands announced over the weekend that they will not participate in Carnival because it's not just about the elections, the postponed vote, and the allegations of fraud, which have sparked violent protests in the streets. But there's a serious economic crisis in the country. The local currency has devalued by 30%. These elections have just really been holding people hostage. So there are questions about security. So even though it's Carnival, people really are not in a Carnival frame of mind.
And how soon will there be another election so Haiti can get a president?
Well, under this proposal, this last minute deal, we should have a second round by the 24th of April, and a new president should be sworn in by May 14th. But I have to tell you, at this point in time, given the reaction that's happening to this agreement, everything is up in the air right now. This provisional government is supposed to be in place for 120 days. The fight has started over the interim president. And then there's the crucial question of who is going to be this consensus prime minister in a country like Haiti that is deeply polarized, where there were more than 100 political parties that participated in the last elections, 54 presidential candidates, over 6,000 candidates overall. I mean, it's a real mess. And so the political actors on the ground really have to figure out how to implement this deal and how to get the country to a second round election so that they can elect a president and the rest of parliament.
Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's Carnival time in Brazil, but the Zika virus has people across the country scared. We want to know what's really going on, so we're sending a reporting team down to Brazil later this week. We'll be partnering with our frontline colleagues here at WGBH and digging in deep on the Zika virus, especially its impact on women. Follow along or join the conversation using the hashtag #HerPlanet. We've got a video previewing our Brazil coverage. You can find it all on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/AcrossWomen'sLives. Coming up, a Dutchman follows the U.S. campaign trail to New Hampshire. They're listening to the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to the world. The New Hampshire political spectacle is in high gear today. Swarms of politicians, Republicans and Democrats, have descended on the state ahead of tomorrow's primary. So, too, have some political junkies from overseas. Willem Post is from the Netherlands. He's an academic and political scientist at the Klingendaal Institute for International Relations in The Hague. Willem, where are you?
Well, I'm standing now just a little bit outside the bakery in Hempstead, New Hampshire. A very small place, and Governor Christie was just here answering questions, giving a short speech. Well, it's basically part of the Democratic folklore. It's like a political fairy tale here for a European, in the sense that we are not naive in Europe. Of course, we know that big interests, big money, media are very important. But still, people knocking on the doors, all the volunteers and the candidates. And now, I think it's still fair to say that it's a wonderful tradition of direct democracy. And I hope that, that they will keep the tradition.
So do people not go door to door in the Netherlands?
No. Not on this scale, anyway.
What are your impressions of New Hampshire voters?
Well, they are taking their responsibility very seriously. I talked to so many people here in New Hampshire, and many of them say, well, I'm independent. I've not made a decision. I'm still hesitating. I'm checking the candidates. So the people in New Hampshire, they take their responsibility very seriously. And partly, it's a bit of a global responsibility they have. So that's what I'm telling them. And well, like I gave an interview to one of the newspapers here. It's the magic of New Hampshire. And that sounds a bit like a fairy tale, huh? Magic. But it's also very serious business, getting the new U.S. president elected. So, yeah, I'm impressed by how serious they take it.
I understand this isn't your first time in New Hampshire for the primary. How many times have you visited?
Well, this is the fourth time. I started in 2004 alone as a commentator. And then for me, it was quite a surprise. It was very cold in Manchester, New Hampshire. It was a snowstorm and a weather alert. And I walked in the streets in Elm Street and basically Main Street in Manchester. There was a lady standing there with a sign, I want to marry John Kerry. And I talked to that lady and I said, well, you're a big fan of then Senator Kerry. And she said, well, he will come into that restaurant in 1 hour. You can talk with him. And I said, come on, I cannot believe that. So I walked into that restaurant, and yes, for 5 or 10 minutes, I talked with him, asking questions. So I was very much impressed by all these kinds of events. So I spread the message in the Netherlands. And then, you know, to make a long story short, I took groups with me. I could have taken hundreds of people from the Netherlands to New Hampshire, but, well, we are guests. We don't want to overwhelm this state with foreigners like me.
What keeps you coming back?
So we keep it a little bit limited.
What keeps you coming back?
Well, still the whole thing that you can test for yourself a little bit, the candidates. And once again, Trump, to see him live and the reactions of the audience, talking with the people, that gives you really a great benefit as someone who's watching U.S. elections, but definitely also as a commentator.
Dutch political scientist Willem Post speaking to us from Hampstead, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot, Willem.
Thank you.
Finally today, in Boston this weekend, there was a memorial service for Mary Fiumara. She passed away last week at the age of 88. Mrs. Fiumara was an icon in the North End, Boston's Italian-American neighborhood. But she became famous nationally for this classic 1969 TV ad where she leans out a window and calls out.
Anthony Martinieri lives in Boston, in the Italian North End, the home of the Prince Spaghetti Company. Most days, Anthony takes his time going home. But today is Wednesday. And in the North End of Boston, Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day.
That boy, Anthony Martinieri, is now 58. He took a break from work to speak to us on the phone earlier. I asked him how old he was when he first met Mary Fiumara.
Oh, I was about 10 years old when I met her. She lived a few doors down from where we used to live in the North End. I mean, she was always a nice, pleasant woman. It was so fun working with her. You know, we just, you know, how you doing, Anthony? How you feeling? Do you need anything? So it was like actually running home to my own mother in a sense.
So how many takes did it take to make the ad?
I lost count. It took a whole weekend because, you know, when you're dealing with the public, everything needs to be perfect. And you had, like, people yelling profanities, or they had to cut the tape, or you had the lighting wasn't right. But it took about 3 or 4 days. To film what it was, like a 30-second commercial.
Did you stay in touch with Mary Fiumara over the years in the North End?
Yes. As I got old, I used to see more of her. Like when I went to a restaurant or a pizza place or in the festivals, I was always bumping into her. And like, she was always introduced me, this is my TV son. And people were like, what do you mean your TV son? And then they put two and two together.
Now, Anthony, you were born in Italy and lived there until you were 9. Where did you grow up in Italy?
It's a little town called Montefalcone. It's about 100 miles from Naples.
What do you remember about your first days as an immigrant in the North End?
Well, it wasn't nerve-wracking. I was 9 years old, and the North End back then was like, you never left Italy. It was all Italian people. Everybody spoke Italian. I went to school. It was all kids that immigrated at the same time when you went to a grocery store or bakery, anywhere. It was people just spoke Italian, as like it wasn't any of your other neighborhoods. You know, I didn't really miss much.
Now, I know you don't live in the North End anymore, but do you ever go there for a hearty plate of pasta?
Much as I can. You know, I go see my old neighborhood. I go see places like Bulbous Bakery I go to all the time. Or I go to some Italian restaurants down there. Not as often as I would like, but I get down there once in a while.
Now, when you think back to those early days, do you think it's easier for Italian immigrants today or back then?
I was 9 years old and, you know, we moved to America and we lived with my grandparents until my parents could find work. But back in those days, you needed a sponsor to come to any country. You want to have somebody find you work. You needed to live with somebody. You didn't just come to this country and say, I'm here, you know. You had to make plans to get here.
Now, I have to ask, do you eat Prince spaghetti?
I eat pasta almost every day. I'm serious. I mean, I eat Prince every day. And back in those days, I mean, that's all there was Prince. I mean, most of the North End, that's all there was Prince. It originated in Boston. A lot of Italian families back in those days, especially, you know, in some days, they used to make their own pasta. I remember my mother breaking the eggs and, you know, mixing it with the flour and, you know, just rolling the pasta around. But if people didn't have time to make it themselves, they used to buy Prince. Yeah, I mean, what Italian person doesn't like pasta?
Anthony Martignetti, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.